How are we kept here? By what bonds are we always exiles? A chirping roar in the silence of foxes, a watery romp of walrus in the long sea lands, or perched on rubbery muskeg like blue teacups, or lost brown mittens. By what agency of restlessness in the driftwood heart? Until on a day the eggs hatch, the young are trained to endurance. Ice rattles the shroud of summer, the flight plan sent, the logbook sand is scribbled on, goodbye, we are going, hurry, and mounting a shaft of sunlight for the mizzen mast of the sky, they climb and go. And that is the way it is? Except perhaps I wonder, do they ever remember, down there in the Southland, Cumberland Sound, and the white places of Baffin? That I will remember soon. A short story in the Canadian Forum for October 1963 called The Undertaker. They were in love. Joe waited every weekday morning at the footbridge for Beth Holliday to meet him, and they walked the rest of the way to school together. In the warm summer evenings after homework was finished, they strolled arm in arm beside the river, where an oily slick from the creosote works rainbowed the water. They had achieved the going-together status, which conferred near-adult dignity among other teenagers. Beth was a very pale girl of Scandinavian origins. Her manner was serious, though none of her schoolmates had ever seen her smile. Oh, my mistake there. Beth was a very pale girl of Scandinavian origins. Her manner was serious. None of her schoolmates had ever seen her smile. Blue lakes for eyes, with blue shadows under them. Blonde hair worn long. Something of the remote princess, the Lady of Shalott. No mirror through which she saw the reflected world, but a heart condition served much the same purpose. Joe never did find out the medical language that characterized this mysterious frailness. He did not ask, but it awed him. Made him regard her with the solicitude of a naturalist for a rare and delicate species, not far from extinction. He carried her school books, elbowed a path through crowds at Saturday night movies, continually interposed his chunky body and florid face between the tall, pale girl and the muscular, hurrying world. Probably it was good for him. Joe was an unimaginative youth, but he felt something of a different fiber from himself in the girl, different also from the shrieking, giggling menage of swaying teenage females at school football games. She talked of books, the poetry of John Keats and Shelley, the romance of Lancelot and Guinevere, Paris and Helen, Abelard and Eloise, people the bewildered Joe had never heard of. She accepted the red-faced homage he bestowed on her, not with any superiority, but a solemn eagerness all her own. There was no doubt that in the pre-Joe years she had been lonely. Medical restrictions prevented the usual games of childhood. Her own temperament, as well as illness, forced her into the introspection of books and music. And Joe was a red-faced wind devil who inexplicably stopped whirling in order to be near her. Once she asked him, "Why do you like me?" Of course, he hadn't been able to answer. "Because I don't laugh and run like the other girls?" "I guess that's it," Joe said, searching his mind earnestly. "Why don't you laugh sometimes? That wouldn't hurt you, would it?" "No, but I can enjoy things without laughing. My mother told me the things that make people laugh always come from doing something I can't do. It'd make my heart go too fast. So I got out of the habit of laughing." She looked at him anxiously. "Am I too serious?" The great blue shadows of her eyes turned on him like deep lakes, whose meaning was too transparent for Joe to fathom. She put her hand on his, the warm, mysterious touch of her illness enthralling him. "If I kissed you," he blurted, would it? "I don't think so. Do you want to?" Calmly, she bent her white face down and touched his lips. Joe was astonished, for the sweet coolness of her face was like rain. It was not like being kissed by a girl at all, with hot freckles and a snub nose mashed against his own sunburned face. He was so astonished he did not want to kiss her again, but went home more bewildered than ever by the mysterious attractions of Beth Holliday. His His serious nature was stilled in her quietness. He bathed himself in her romantic fancies, cool dreams in which were infinite distances, overhung by mist that never allowed him to see the ending of any story. Gradually he came to feel he had arrived at the finish of a love affair, but the end was the same as the middle and the beginning, as if they had been married a long time and grown old together, all their children gone away, leaving them the timeless calm of aftermath in which there was no urgency but a slow waiting for death. She was 17. One day in school, Joe noticed a pair of legs. They were brown, rather short legs, with a girl attached. She grinned at him, and he grinned back. On the weekend, they went swimming, Joe chasing her round and round the raft, anchored 100 yards from the beach. He chased her afterwards, down the narrow sand strip in the sun, pursued her under moonlight, brown legs flashing ahead and waiting to be caught. He left school that year, having developed sufficient speed of foot to overtake a succession of brown girls, freckle girls, red-lipped girls, pursuing them into streets and restaurants, and sometimes grounding them at last in sunless, old-fashioned front parlors with "Thou Shalt Nots" prominent on faded wallpaper. But he did, for they were always caught. There was some cool quality about Joe's red face that attracted females. He didn't try to figure it out. All the nascent forces of adolescence bursting inside him at once allowed no time for such introspection. The town's only undertaker at that time was old John Clegg, whose assistant had recently departed elsewhere to set up his own establishment. Clegg was touching 70 when Joe applied for a job, not in the best of health either. Joe's junior matriculation certificate was the open sesame. He took up his new duties with zest and the peculiar coolness he had acquired before leaving high school. After 2 years of learning the rudiments and niceties of the embalming business at a school in Toronto, graduating second in his class, Joe took over more and more of the duties old Clegg had delegated to his previous assistant. He knew the exact mixture of glycerin and formaldehyde to pour into the round glass water cooler and its pumping apparatus. He sterilized the knives and chrome instruments in the manner of one born to the job. At first, the cadavers had nauseated him. He had to retire to the bathroom when first witnessing the old man's deft slicing of a carotid artery, but recovered in time to assist at his own gruesome initiation. Old Clegg informed him that the He had to retire to the bathroom when first witnessing the old man's deft slicing of a carotid artery, but recovered in time to assist at his own gruesome initiation. Old Clegg informed him that the carotid was the best place for insertion of a rubber tube that pumped embalming fluid into the corpse. "Some says it ain't," the old man muttered, with liver-spotted hands steady on the dead man's neck. "But the carotid's a main artery, easy to find. Now watch." Clegg slit the dead man's throat like a chicken, cut into the red, fruit-like arterial tissue, deftly inserting the rubber tube. "Now here's the jugular," he informed his apprentice with a grin. "It's right there beside the carotid. Shove that other tube in there to take the blood as it gets pumped out by the embalming fluid coming in." Joe's mouth and throat were dry, but he did as he was told. Clegg nodded approval. "Corpses don't mind much if you can't find that artery first time around, but it makes a messy job, especially if it's a woman. You gotta make damn sure the incision is covered." He started the pumping apparatus, and Joe watched the level of pale green embalming fluid descend in its round glass bowl. Later he poured the bucket of blood sloshing down the sink, rinsing afterwards. Once in those early days of his apprenticeship, there was a minor catastrophe. Joe forgot to place the tube carrying outgoing blood into a bucket provided for that purpose. Blood was filmed 1/4 inch thick on the tile floor when old Clegg noticed it, cursing Joe for his mistake with lucid amiability. After mopping and scrubbing for nearly an hour on that occasion, Joe was never so forgetful again. 10 years after entering the undertaking business, Joe was given his own nervous and shaking apprentice, and Clegg went into retirement. "You do the work and I'll take the money," the old man cackled. "Besides, it's getting so my hands won't hold still long enough to do a job." He held the shaking, liver-spotted hands up for Joe to inspect. You'll be doing the same job on me one of these days. He looked at the younger man shrewdly. You got any money? Enough to buy the business, I mean? Joe hadn't, but the bank was obliging enough to lend it to him at low interest rates. 2 years later, old Clegg died, and, as the old man had predicted, Joe did a job on him. Standing in the imitation mahogany panel chapel, he considered business matters with some satisfaction. Appreciation of the young man's professional services was rising steadily. He attended the United Church on Sundays, when not otherwise engaged, and sang a good strong tenor, which made the minister shake his hand approvingly after the sermon. Besides, Joe was able to throw a fair amount of business in the Reverend's direction. The church was an excellent place to make business and social contacts, Joe had found. In the colored sunlight, shaped into curves and rectangles by the tinted glass windows, he sometimes allowed his eyes to rest on a charming face or trim legs, being careful to keep his chin poised at the same upward angle while doing so. Nothing like an undertaker for a respectability, he reflected, his good tenor joining the gravel-throated congregation in Throw at the Lifeline, then settling down on the oak bench to mentally exclude the sermon, vacant eyes staring into the space while the hard pinpoint of his mind centered on a girl's soft neck. She squirmed knowingly and threw a glance over his shoulder in the midst of a rolling vowel, but Joe did not move a muscle. Thinking of the girl in front of him, he suddenly remembered bringing in a fresh cadaver with old Clegg, stretching it out on the white enameled embalming table. He had touched the naked body, then jumped back, startled. It was hot, almost like fire. The old man grinned. Fresh beef ain't had time to cool yet. Soon as anyone dies, their temperature shoots up like a skyrocket. Don't know why, but that's the way it is. Like they wanted to live some more, and that was the only way they could show it. Joe's eyes touched the short hairs on the nape of the girl ahead of him. She twitched in nervous awareness. Her neck looked flushed and hot. After the service, he spoke to the girl and her mother, shook their white-gloved hands. Later, he saw the mother whisper something to her daughter. He guessed what it was and grinned inside. At the age of 30, Joe had become a well-rounded figure in his gray trousers and dark jacket. His face was still a healthy red, with blunt features, a manner at once cordial and slightly withdrawn, as became his profession. Perhaps the old schoolboy romance with Beth Holliday had something to do with him remaining single. Sometimes he saw her go by the chapel on her way to work at the library. She was in charge of children's books, presiding over fairy tales and science for young people, with blonde serenity. She always went by the chapel going to and from work, passing on the opposite side of the street, and carrying an umbrella, whether it was raining or not. He wondered about it once, that umbrella, perhaps for protection against male advances. He smiled to himself, all that hogwash about Lancelot and Guinevere, the stainless knight of the round table she had expected him to be, the mystery of an illness without outward symptoms, but left her invalid within. That was probably hogwash, too. He was no use to any man. Every afternoon she walked by the chapel at 5:10, passing under the big chestnut tree with pale, serious face, a little thinner now, hands clutching an umbrella. He thought of his latest girlfriend, comparing the two of them, feature by feature. But there was really no comparison at all. Sylvie was dark, all fire and thumping passion, with big white billows of breasts for a man to lie between. Sometimes she'd bite while they were making love, and bite hard. Later he'd ask her to keep her teeth away from his carotid artery, explaining its significance in his profession. They'd both laugh. It had been a stock joke with Joe for years now. Lately he'd taken to using the little room off the chapel for his assignments. The room was actually meant for mourners who found themselves a little overcome while paying their last respects to a dear one. The couch was very useful for erotic passages as well, and he discovered the atmosphere of the chapel to have a stimulating effect, which caused his partners to give of their best. Naturally, such extracurricular guests had to enter by a rear door, left unlocked by prearrangement. Joe sighed a little. Perhaps he was tired of Sylvia's full-blown charms. There'd been a new girl in town for the last few days, a waitress at Joe's Cafe. Came from Montreal, she said, though he didn't believe it. She sounded too much American, a teasing trace of the deep South in her voice, like a cream-fed cat. Her name was Julie. He thought she might be in the country illegally at first, but scoffed at himself for the idea. What American girl would enter Canada illegally? Still working in a joint like Joe's Cafe? For Joe Barona was a real tough nut. He'd tried to get him to change the name of the restaurant a while back. It might remind people of the Eternal Rest Chapel and its new proprietor. But Joe Barona wouldn't change a thing. He thought of the black-jowled Italian with distaste. Julie, working at Barona's dingy little greasy spoon. Slender Julie with bold eyes and broad hips, dishing up chow for small-town customers. People looked at Julie and sometimes forgot all about their food. A dish, the kind you don't meet in church. He frowned. She'd said no to him twice. But that was to be expected. No girl wants to look easy, and Joe never mince words after a certain stage in his ritual courtship. He put it right on the line, not baldly stated in so many words, but nevertheless unmistakable. A combination of oblique words and bold admiring glances. Julie would succumb eventually, he was sure. Outside the sky was black, thunder smacking its lips high among the clouds. Rain began to fall in great drops. A long bar of sunlight touched the green chestnut leaves across the street. It reminded Joe, standing just inside the chapel door, of the stained green glass light in church. But here there was no girl, no sensitive white neck for the sunlight to touch and make aware of his glance. Thought was still unfinished when he saw Beth Holliday coming on from the end of the block. Before she reached the chestnut tree, black skies unbolted and rain came down in solid sheets. The girl came to a sudden halt under the tree, rain pouring outside the chestnut's periphery, weird green light piercing the leaves and resting on her blonde head. She was pretty wet, Joe noted with a twinge of pity. She'd forgotten her umbrella, too. He half turned to go back in the shop and find her an umbrella, then stopped. It might mean the beginning of something for which he had no taste any longer. He stood hidden behind the curtain, watching her while the rain poured. Beth looked toward the chapel once, pale and serious. The blue shadows under her eyes enlarged enormously. He could see her clearly from the chapel, as if they had been walking across the footbridge together in an earlier rainfall, pearl beads of water spangling her hair, Joe carrying her books as before, Lancelot and Guinevere. Again he turned to get her an umbrella. He came back just in time to see the girl running away down the street. It was the first time he had ever seen her running. The very first time. Next day was Tuesday, fair and bright, the sky washed clear of rain. Joe and his assistant received a call from the small local hospital in the morning. It was to pick up the body of Beth Holliday, and in turn explain what happened as they wheeled the stretcher into position. Rheumatic heart, he said tersely. She got caught in the rainstorm yesterday and ran to get home. Her heart wouldn't take that sort of thing. The intern slapped his hands together expressively and said, "Woof!" Once, before they reached the embalming room, he touched her hand. It was fiery hot. He recoiled as if from a leper, noticing his assistant eye him curiously. Body heat goes up immediately after death, Joe explained, and found himself echoing old Clegg almost word for word. Don't know why. It's like she wanted to live some more, and that was the only way to show it. He blinked, not tears, for he didn't feel grief exactly, just blinked rapidly, and thought of yesterday, her standing in the rain, himself inside. If he'd got that umbrella for her right away, without waiting to think about it, she might be alive. He shrugged himself out of the mood quickly. Just the same, it was hard to believe she was dead, even with the draped evidence of her body in front of him. Later he gave his helper the rest of the day off, seeing the young man's eyes turn knowledgeable and wise. That couldn't be helped. He prepared the embalming fluid slowly, shaking his head with dogged wonder at himself. Things he hadn't thought of for years. The girl holding onto his arm, exclaiming at some trifling color of leaf she'd seen, wanting him to notice it also. The trust she'd had in him, something he hadn't realized at the time, but remembered now. Not really a human girl, for she'd asked nothing from life, and that was exactly what she'd got. But how could he know that without looking into her mind, a thing he'd never done? Naked on the white table, Beth Holliday lost no dignity, as if long-expected death had not changed her in any essential way. Awkwardness suggested by clothing was erased. Her limbs were liquid white and belonged to her body like the joined arms of the same moonlit sea. Joe muttered something, listened in on himself to find out what he was thinking. "She can't be dead," he heard, but she was. Closed eyes with night blue shadows, serious sweet mouth, pale gold nipples pointing up at the glaring eye like 200-watt bulb. Oops. Closed eyes with night blue shadows, serious sweet mouth, pale gold nipples pointing up at the glaring eye like 200-watt bulb. Pale, pale pubic hair mounted impregnably now forever. He could have wept for himself, but a moment later he had lost the capacity again. Joe was a furious man, and anger seized him. He took his steel instruments and slit the white throat, finding the carotid with practiced certainty, listened to the low chugging of the electric pump push her blood into a galvanized bucket. It made a quiet slurping sound, like a large amount of tomato soup in the mouth of a fat man. He went out afterwards, drank a bottle of rye whiskey, then went round to his namesake's cafe to see Julie. The slender, perhaps American girl made half promises, but no firm commitment. Joe was surly. "Okay," he told her, "I've been drinking. Sometimes I do drink a little too much, but it makes no difference. You know I want you." And she did know, but Joe didn't look so respectable at this moment. His face was a bright crimson shade from whiskey, though strangely, this seemed to make his blunt features almost handsome with the virility of blood and fascination of that neutrality pact undertakers have with death. He explained to her about the unlocked door of the chapel building. She smiled, her objection seeming to give way suddenly. "All right, I'll come." "You won't be scared?" he asked. The girl said no, she was not afraid, and he knew from her eyes that she was not. "After midnight, then. I'll be waiting." With no more words, he left. All next day, the few friends and acquaintances of Beth Holliday filed into the funeral chapel, signed their names in the book, and went solemnly away. Some of them gave Joe a remembering look, but he ignored the glances, stiffly erect in gray trousers and neat dark jacket, so drunk he could scarcely stand. At 11 o'clock that night, he locked the front door and went to get another bottle of whiskey before Julie arrived. He managed to obtain only a small 12-ounce bottle from the town bootlegger, drank half it in an alley, and shoved the bottle in his pocket. His mind kept going back to the pale dead girl in her wooden box, surrounded by flowers. "Guinevere," he snarled aloud. "Guinevere and her damned umbrella." He drank the rest of the Mickey in one gulp, heaving the bottle down the middle of the dark, empty street. No heads popped out of windows to investigate the clattering sound. Town was asleep, only a vague light here and there behind misty curtains. Joe went down the alley behind the undertaking parlors, entering the rear door. He flung off his coat, then stumbled over a chair on his way to the mourner's room. "Too early," he said drunkenly to himself. "She won't be here yet." But she was. A naked girl arose to meet him in the darkness, the street light outside projecting tiger stripes through the steel blinds, marking the girl's flesh as if she were a beast, as perhaps she was, for he felt her claws and teeth, the gyrating hips that plunged at him, grating on pelvic bones, made this touching of bodies as much combat as love passage. "Julie," he muttered, "you're a bitch." He seized her arms and bore her down on the couch. Drowned in sticky sweat and the musky smell of coupling, he could not think of the dead girl any longer. Julie held him tightly, the swift unison of their plunging movement, pushing them together and apart like the courtship of sweating ghosts. There was a brief resistance at first, but over quickly. The pleasure of having his mind blanked out, physical sensation replacing thought, an epileptic freedom that battered at walls of darkness. The girl's body anticipated every movement of his own, a slight hesitation before the downstroke, herself surging up to meet him, and both hovering momentarily, as if it were a mating of birds in mid-air. Orgasm, all his teeth magically transferred to the loins, and the medieval dentist, was pulling them out rapidly, violently, one by one. The bones of his body dissolved in a last convulsive spasm, leaving his flesh collapsed like a limp umbrella spread over the girl. He felt a fainting sickness suddenly come over him and broke away from her. "I'll be right back, honey," he gasped, running to the bathroom in the rear to pour cold water over his head. When he returned a few seconds later, she was gone. Without questioning the girl's disappearance, he dropped, exhausted, onto the couch and slept. Next morning, the sun came up. Joe struggled groggily from the couch, feeling beaten all through his body, strangely lightheaded. He lifted the steel blinds to examine the couch carefully, but the red velour showed nothing. When the young assistant came to work, Joe told him to look after things and went back to sleep. At 9 o'clock, the phone rang, someone for Joe. He got into his clothes hurriedly, dashing into the office under the staring eyes of his helper. It was Julie. "Joe," she said. "Joe?" "Yeah, what do you want?" "I'm sorry, Joe." "You're sorry?" "I said I was sorry. I just couldn't make it last night." "What?" "I couldn't make it. Listen, I'll come tonight, Joe. I'll be there for sure tonight. You're not mad, Joe? Joe?" He left the phone lying on the desk, gargling to itself, and went back to the chapel, where the pale girl was lying in her wooden box, surrounded by a kingdom of flowers. He saw that she was smiling.